Blog Talk Radio.
That was the great Charlie Parker. This is Walter Dean from last night. I had so many comments that came back to me concerning the show that I did. Yesterday I made an attempt to do a show on the great saxophone player Charlie Parker. I was well prepared, and however, my computer started doing its own thing. And I decided that I needed to go back in my recesses and remember what my father said. If you're going to do it right, or don't do it at all. Those were his famous words. So what I decided to do was to redo the show, because Charlie Parker was so instrumental in music that it was important that we give proper respect for his skills and abilities. And so that song you just heard was Charlie Parker and Strings, probably one of the best albums that he ever put together. But we're going to listen to some more and about Charlie Parker. And this time, hopefully, it will work out like I want it to. First of all, you're going to be listening to Sonny Rawls, who actually knew Charlie Parker and played along with him at different intervals. The real Charlie Parker is what he's talking about. So let's listen.
Charlie's a prophet.
We know Charlie Parker's music and love it. And we know part of his story, which is the tabloid side, the seedier side, the troubles. But there's another side to Charlie Parker that not so many people talk about. Sonny Rollins was there, and now he tells us the other side of Charlie Parker.
Charlie Parker represented the only black artist in performing performance, and was very dignified. So he was going against the grain. Most black musicians had to start to train a little bit, you know, a little busy. Nothing wrong with that. That's just, you come up and maybe it's the type of person busy is. Unfortunately, by being an entertainer, you prohibited that next social step in black integration into the American culture, because you were stereotyped as being an entertainer, even though some great musicians and entertainers, look at Louis Jordan. He was a man, that was the first guy that got me into music, really, listening to Fanny Snacks. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not putting these people down at all. That's the era that they came up in. That was the moon at that time. Except people like Colin Hawkins, Clinton Road, so I'm sure there are others. Over the age when Charlie Parker was the guy that we kind of heard his music more in our head. Although I never lost touch with any older people, but I mean, if you're 15 years old today, you're going to be into hip hop. If you're 15 years old, as we were in that time, you're going to be into bebop. Charlie Parker was a guy that was very dignified when he played. And he was playing so much fantastic music, highly intricate, involved, complicated, intellectual, that he had to be recognized, and not just great music, but as a person that was an artist, not an entertainer. And that was very important for us, because we were coming up after the war. A lot of people wanted to mature more than the American mainstream. Charlie Parker to us represented that. He was a very great figure. I think culturally was sort of taken over the mantle now with a lot of people, but Bird was definitely our inspiration.
The person you just heard was Sonny Rollins, a person that you might consider who played music that with a tenor saxophone, was a genius in his own right. Told you a story about Parker on the other side of Charlie Parker. Now we're going to listen to chapter one on what we might call Bird. This was done quite some time ago, so listen very carefully.
The story of Charlie Parker. Outside of that, you know, it's just another saxophone.
And The first day Barnes was Land of the River, And I knew it's complete too. And I thought, oh, that'd be never stop saying about them other keys and nothing like that. So I took a little one out to this joint where a guy, a bunch of fellas who I had seen around where, and the first thing they started playing was Body So Lonely, you know. So I go to play about any stuff early. I mean, there ain't no formal condemnation. You know, so.
There are some humiliating setbacks. The notorious one, if it's completely true, being the jam session when young Perkin was donned off stage, more or less literally, by Count Basie's drummer, Joe Jones, whom we just heard on Lady Be Good. Just as Perkin was getting into a solo, Jones detached a large cymbal and frisbeed it across the stage towards him, and it landed with a great crash that reportedly robbed Charlie of the will to play for weeks, if not months. But he recovered his morale, and before too long was playing in one of the new local groups aspiring to replace Count Basie, whose band had departed to New York. Jay McCann was the band leader, and a few years ago at a Parker Symposium in Kansas City, I asked him about that.
Yeah, some people would say to start a big band, especially in those days, was, you know, you're asking for a lot of trouble. Was it a big decision for you?
It was a big decision. Well, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, because, you see, I had a small group at that time. They wanted about 14, 15-piece groups, see? And that was the decision for me, you know, making up my mind to throw away the small group, which I never should have done, and grab the big group, you know. So I grabbed the big group, but I was lucky enough to come out of it.
McCann had the reputation of being an enthusiastic carouser, but he was also highly organized in his preparation of the band. On its early trial gigs, he would leave the rhythm section playing on stage while he rehearsed the brass in an upstairs room.
And after the first 2 hours, I'd bring them down and put the brass section on the bandstand with the rhythm section and send readings upstairs to rehearse. And then after about 2 or 3 weeks, then I brought it down and put it together, and the guy here had all that brass screaming and, you know, the reeds moaning. And they say, we like that, we like that. I said, well, just don't stop me from rehearsing like I've been doing. I said, the rhythm section will take care of everything out here. Just let me continue to do it. He said, okay. So that's how I got the big band together.
Yeah.
So we were ready for a little when we finished that gig, see.
Charlie Parker played briefly with McCann at this stage and with another local leader called Harlan Leonard, but he wasn't yet ready to apply himself to the regular attendance required of members of a large group. He never really was. Besides, and this is a part of his story that can never quite be explained, Charlie Parker, even before his saxophone technique was fully in order, felt in his head that there were other, more ambitious ways of playing this music. So he set off to New York by himself to see if he could find in the flesh what he was almost hearing in imagination. He traveled in traditional bluesman style by hopping a freight train. Jazz in New York was reaching a pitch of technical expertise where the fluency of the players was beginning to expose the limitations of the basic material. When John Kirby's band recorded Rehearsing for a Nervous Breakdown in 1938, the title might have been a prediction of the way things were going. Though there were a few players around whose virtuosity seemed always in step with their creative imagination. The octave of the late 30s, as you
reported that Charlie Parker washed dishes in the club where Tatum played in hopes of enough time off to hear what the great man was doing. But Tatum, of course, was available to be heard elsewhere. And he wasn't alone, as Billy Taylor points out, in seeking to expand the borders of music making.
I remember back in the 30s, one of the most popular songs. Now that's in the 30s, so yeah, and it starts off with a major 7. You know, Clarence Prophet was a man who used to jam with Tatum, and they would do some of the most unusual things that I ever heard. They would play, take a song like Body and Soul and improvise on the harmony. They'd play the melody. And so instead of like, they would, you know, now all he's doing is chromatic. You know, in those days, you know, no one was thinking, most people were not thinking along those lines. And people were thinking if it's harmony, it goes, it's relatively simple.
There were other elements, too, that seem now to have been pointing forward to the music Parker eventually made. One was the trend for novelty riff tunes with surprising displaced rhythmic accents. Even Fats Waller and his rhythm occasionally went in for those. Critic Leonard Feather, who certainly knew which way the winds of musical fashion were blowing in those days. All those elements and more were available to be worked on in New York, but the chord extensions are certainly the most important factor. Parker found an ally for his researches in a guitarist called William Biddy Fleet, with whom he played both experimentally after hours and as a surviving poster shows in formal club engagements. Fleet was a man who seems never to have recorded, except, curiously, at a ramshackle 1938 session in Baltimore with the New Orleans piano pioneer Jelly Roll Morton. A most curious link between the origins of jazz and its newest explorer. Jelly Roll Morton hadn't too much time for other pianists' tunes, but there, curiously enough, with Biddy Fleet, he was playing Fats Waller's Honeysuckle Rose, one of the favorite jamming tunes for Kansas City players. In fact, when we hear Charlie Parker immortalized for the very first time in an amateur recording from 1940, he's playing that same tune, entirely unaccompanied. By then, he was back in Kansas City, sounding perhaps more advanced in manner than in harmonic complexity. That peeling quality his phrases had was something he'd picked up from a local sax master called Buster Smith. Charlie's progress must have been attracting attention because on rejoining the J. McShann band, he found that his style was being copied, as the leader couldn't help noticing.
Well, you see, there was a little young cat named John Jackson. J.J. was sitting back there listening to Bird. Bird had no idea J.J. had been picking up on. JJ could outread Bird at the time too, you know. So one night, Bird was late getting to the stand. So I told JJ, take the solo, take the solo. And Bird was way back in the back of the room. JJ blowing his solo. Bird flew up there to the bandstand. He says, man, don't ever give this cat none of my solos, no. No more solos. Don't give him no more of my solos. No. I said, what's the matter? He said, no, I don't want to blow none of my solos. I want to keep all of my solos. Okay. But that was the only time I ever seen that, you know, Bird really get, you know, he had part of his cat, he always had pretty good control of himself. And that was one of the few times I've seen him kind of, you know, lose it a little bit, you know.
The nickname Bird, by the way, seems certain to have arisen from the fuller version Yardbird, but whether that arose from Parker's eating a lot of chicken, Yardbird was a down-home name for that, or whether it was because he hung around the backyards of Kansas City clubs when he was too young to go in, or for any other reason, will never definitely be known. Back to New York he went with the McShann Band, which thrived there. The habit of experimental jamming at venues better known to musicians than the public had really caught on, and Clark Munro's Uptown House, and even more Minton's Playhouse, were now the places to try out your newest ideas. The short-lived guitarist Charlie Christian recorded there, showing how much the emerging music owed to guitarists, particularly in the matter of length of phrase. Guitar players didn't have to pause for breath. Swing to Bop, a title applied later to indicate what seemed to be happening in that performance at Milton's.
Milton's gets most of the credit because that was the most visible place, but those kind of sessions that were happening all over New York in those days. There were plenty of places to play, and guys got together in people's houses and all kinds of things, in addition to going to the Mint. The Mint was a place where you could play long, as long and as loud as you wanted to, so that made it very special.
Dr. Billy Taylor. Playing as long as wind and inspiration lasted was a great luxury. On records, in a biggish band, you were lucky to get one full chorus or half of one. But Charlie Parker stayed with Jay McShann long enough to make records giving sure indications of what was to come. On the Jumpin' Blues in 1942, for example, he started his solo with a pet phrase that was later built into the famous bebop anthem called Ornithology. Walter Brown at the time was the selling point of the record, but it's treasured now for that proto-Parker solo. Soon after that came an important phase in Charlie's development that remains largely untraceable in sound because of the Musicians Union recording ban that kept the band out of the studios from August 1942 until, in some cases, late 44. So we missed the moment at the end of 42 when Charlie Parker joins the big band of the veteran pianist Earl Hines, where Dizzy Gillespie is already featured in the trumpet section. Hines himself once recalled how much those two practiced together.
Charlie was a tight fellow that he knew his instrument, and he never ventured out to do something he couldn't do. And he and Dizzy Gillespie used to take the exercise book and go in the dressing room between shows and play the exercises. And later they inserted these things that they learned from the exercise book into tunes, and that's who would play them.
Parker played tenor sax in Hines' band because that's what was needed. And there is a private hotel room recording from early 1943 made by an enthusiast called Bob Redcross, where you and I and Lawrence Schoenberg can hear how he sounded.
The Redcross recordings, you know, with Dizzy and Oscar Pettiford and those different things. Those are really interesting because on the tenor, he's just another good tenor player. Kind of. I mean, if you were to listen to that recording of Sweet Georgia Brown with Pettiford and Gillespie, On the one hand, yeah, I mean, if you listen real carefully, of course, you'll say, yes, he's playing phrases that other people weren't phrasing, and you're playing quite that way. But it wouldn't stop you in your tracks, and that's always amazed me.
Dizzy Gillespie, addressed to Yard, the alternative shortening of Yardbird. But that human cry, childlike cry, perhaps, that his alto sax tone launched upon the air, was muffled by the tenor sax, and used the tenor rarely after that time. Now the singer Billy Eckstine left Earl Hines and formed his own band of out-and-out experimenters, including both Gillespie and Parker, but that too didn't record till Parker had left. In fact, for many music followers, he remained a creature of myth at least until 1944, when a group of recordings by the Tiny Grimes Quintet came out. These were not the most advanced players of the time, but Tiny Grimes himself was Art Tatum's guitarist, so he was certainly not afraid of daring music, and Parker was able to show that there was a new edge, several new edges, to his playing. Search was clearly paying off, but gigging on 52nd Street in New York, he was leading a fast life, as ever. In January 1945, he and Gillespie played a session on which a veteran vaudevillian called Rubber Legs Williams sang some blues, but not quite in the style he'd intended. In conversation with Leonard Feather, Parker explained that the innards of a Benzedrine inhaler were responsible.
You said I was for coffee and sandwiches. So I took the thing out of one of these inhaler tools and threw it in my coffee. He drank it, got confused.
Oh, help me God, it really did, man.
And Robert drank it. And he's, you know, he said, like, you know how you have a bit of mission or something, you know, and the car today. My 20 was his mother, he made that record.
Oh, that's
his
power. Oh, it sounds like it on the record.
My friend went down. Yeah,
I heard about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Y
That was Charlie's third wife, Doris, in the background. The interest in the story is not that Rubberlegs Williams' name suddenly came true as his vocals disintegrated into roaring incoherence, but that Parker took the Benzedrine so much for granted. He was already immune to such comparatively mild stimulants. And surely would have shown no audible effect himself if he had drunk the contaminated coffee. Next time we'll see how musical genius and narcotic fixation continued to grow in parallel. I'm Russell Davis, and this was an Associated Media Fusion production for BBC Radio 2. The producer was Graham Class.
I used to talk about it, but it's all over now. I've been under the delusion. The devil's out, you know I'm going to win me big. I'm going to win me big. I'm going to win, baby, just to worry you all.
That was a long story about Charlie Bird, Parker, Jai Bird, whichever one you want to use. During the early years of his life as a saxophone player, and the person who actually traveled around to find out what other people were doing. And I found it to be really interesting. We're not going to have enough time to do the whole set for the next part of Charlie Parker, but we're going to try to play something about him. And we're going to see if, in fact, this particular part of Charlie Parker's life might be as interesting as the one we just previously heard. We won't be able to finish it, but I'll start off next week with the conclusion once we come to the conclusion for this week. Wherever we stop, we will continue. Here it is.
Davis with part three of Birdsong, the story of Charlie Parker. We'll rejoin the story after its most famous pause, passed on from a psychopathic woman at the county jail to the Camarillo State Hospital for 6 months there. Charlie Parker dried out, chilled out, worked in a vegetable garden, and received visits from Doris Sidmore, his partner-to-be. Released at the end of January 47, he was welcomed back to society at a jam session party where recordings are made. The best-known tracks are still known as Home Cooking, but their sources are obvious. In this case, Cherokee, still Parker's favorite practice. His official recording career for Dial Records resumed almost at once. Parker's insistence on having a favorite vocalist, Earl Coleman, recorded at his comeback session meant that most of the studio time was given over to the singer. But several instrumental masterpieces were crowned with a few minutes left. Pianist Earl Garner didn't have the expected bebop style, but it was a finished style on its own terms, and the contrast was piquant. I'm blues. New themes emerged at a sextet session a week later, though Parker was over an hour late for the session. The titles sounded positive, cheers, stupendous, the ironic carving a bird, and relaxing at Camarillo. The blues theme, the other players found it hard to get completely right. One of the phenomena of bebop was Parker's memory for all its complex themes. But according to the pianist Sadiq Hakim, Parker's memory for everything was exceptional.
Well, it just was. Oh, no, no, no. It just was. Okay. He didn't wait for the crying. Because he had no sorry. I can't go on. But I didn't go on. So, you know, I was trying to mentally play on this. And, I was talking to him since the first chapter, the fifth year. Perfect. Just in a matter of a few days, he had consumed all of himself. That's what I mean.
The band Parker now sat up with Harold McGee, the trumpeter, who tried to drag him through the disastrous Loverman session, gained a residency at the Heidi Ho Club. An enthusiastic Dean Benedetti had started recording Parker from several vantage points in various clubs, often sitting in the room with his disc recording machine, trailing a microphone line on the trouser out to a reason to come out. It's the beginning of a period when an immense number of Parker performances were recorded in studios, but also informally behind the scenes, in clubs, off air, and in concerts. Altogether, it's probable that of Parker's short playing career, a greater proportion was recorded in one form or another than of any other musicians before or since.
I think it's fair to say that you can have a handle on not the totality, but a large percentage of the way that these men created.
Lauren Schoenberg, executive director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem.
Now, granted, all we know is what they did when they were in front of the microphone. And with the Benedetti recordings, we do have Bird at 4 a.m. in some record. Even having said that, I still think that Parker did have more different dialects, more different approaches than virtually any other jazz improviser that I've ever found. And I think that you find it most explicitly on the Benedetti records. And then the Benedetti records make it possible to go back to the Savoy records or the Dial records and begin to really decipher the subtle little changes in syntax in the way he does things. I mean, I do think that he was, for the most part, like most recording artists, playing it a little less dangerously.
Yes.
On the studio recording.
And I always feel that there are lots of things you hear The voice players playing live that you don't hear on record. I found out one thing about Charlie Parker, that he had a tremendous sense of humor, and he would use it in his playing. When he almost invented the double tempo run, you know, that flurry of notes that go twice as fast as they should do, you assumed he did it for musical reasons. But on the night that I saw him, the club was crowded on a Saturday night, and two rather blousy looking blondes came past the stand, one wearing a sort of Angora sweater, which tacitly revealed what was underneath. Well, not so tacitly either. And as she walked past the stand, Parker looked and opened his eyes and played the most fantastic double tempo phrase I've ever heard in my life, and the whole place laughed. And that's when you don't much get people take Charlie Parker and that group of players on so seriously that they think it's sacrilege to laugh, but he didn't think so that night.
Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker on alto, Miles Davis on trumpet, Tommy Potter on bass, the great Max Roach on drum. To start things jumping without wasting too much time, the Birds, Grooving High.
Parker and Torres returned to New York in Easter 1947, and much of the rest of his story was played out there. He formed a regular quintet with Miles Davis, Duke Jordan piano, Tommy Potter bass, and Max Roach drums, often introduced on the radio, as in that case, by the voice of Symphony Sid Torrid. Miles Davis was still the ingenue of the troupe, but registered some beautiful moments on the recordings that autumn. Parker played superbly, and Duke Jordan, though now Bud Powell at the faster tempos, was a most sympathetic ballad accompanist, much appreciated by Professor Dan Morgenstern of the Institute for Jazz Studies.
Duke Jordan, in a way, I mean, when it comes to playing in a band, maybe Duke is better than Bud, you know, for that, because for one thing, he plays the most beautiful introductions. His introductions are marvelous, aren't they? I mean, through all those dial sides, they're just like textbook introduction. And beautiful solos, they're simpler than Bud, certainly, but also beautiful sense of harmony and touch, and it gets a very, you know, gets a lovely sound out of the piano.
are capable of changing people's lives in drastic ways. That's the singer Sheila Jordan, you told me.
I came to New York. I was chasing Charlie Parker and married Duke Jordan so I could get next to Bird. Sort of.
It was the writer Gary Gibbons who pointed out that that repeated phrase of Parker's was, in a sense, a found item, a fragment of a given remedy. In a fine example of how one wild search can benefit another, Gibbons was writing Bing Crosby's biography and happened on a recording by Dick Todd, who was the reading at the time, of the Canadian Crosby. Todd's recording of A Table on the Corner went like this. So skillfully was that phrase lifted and repositioned in its new context by Parker, but it was decades before anyone noticed. Solid work where Parker was either resident in Rome or touring other cities over his own ages or with the job at the Philharmonic stage shows. Towards the end of the decade, his musical home in New York became the club called the Royal Roost.
It was on Broadway and 49th Street, and it was down a flight, so it had a fairly low ceiling. It was a basement type room. He had a lot of vines and trees, and it had a great ambiance. Run by a man like Ralph Watkins. When he saw so much business, he did what you and I might do and said, I'll get a bigger place, right? And he took over the old Zanzibar nightclub on 49th Street up above, one flight up. Had a great big showroom, like a theater room. Lost the complete feel of the Royal Roost, and it never really did too good. I mean, it did okay for about 2 years. And he told me personally, he said, Ed, I should have stayed in the Roost. It had the feel, that closer feel for jazz, particularly, you know, the lower ceiling. It wasn't a big showroom. It was a nightclub. And people just seemed to like that feel, you know.
I remember one night when there were only three of us in the club, and they didn't know what to play. It's when Miles was with the band as well. They didn't know what to play, so they called out any requests. And one of the first records I'd ever bought was Donna Lee, musicians now are on the chord structure of Indiana. Mm. And at that time, nobody knew it, and we had to get it off the record. And so I shouted Donna Lee, and immediately they counted in the same tempo, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, but started playing it twice as fast. And that took us all by surprise, because we never heard it that fast before. Mm. But it showed that they were still wide awake and doing it to see whether they could do the actual fight. So it sounded pretty good to me.
So, because Doris Parker and my girlfriend at the time, who worked in the head check room, were friendly, we would sit together. I would sit with Bird when the third act was on, you know, and we got to be friendly. And he gave me so many good tips. He told me to buy Stravinsky records because I liked Odd Meters and Time. Told me to buy the Firebird and the Rite of Spring and get the scores. He said, Eddie, you love Odd Times. You got to hear what Stravinsky does. He was a mile wide as far as a person goes. I mean, you talk about eclectic. He once, while we were talking in the club, he said, you have to come uptown with me someday. I said, why, Bird? What's going on? He said, I eat lunch in a Hungarian restaurant uptown, and he said, they have a string quartet up there playing Hungarian music. They swing better than we do. I mean, he listened to everything.
As was proved when the critic Leonard Feather conducted Parker throughout London and Downbeat magazine, eliciting his comments on various forms of music, from concert classics to Dixieland. He exhibited at least a tolerance for all of them and an enthusiasm for most. At one point, a Johnny Hodges sax feature with Duke Ellington was played.
That was Duke. I know. Featuring Johnny Livingston Hodges.
That's the one with my part.
It's a fact. I've always took a look at the Johnny Hodges because that record deserves all the stars you can muster.
Okay.
Well, you know what I think?
We're going to have to stop right here. I didn't want to, but we have to. His time is up. You've been listening to the Great Charlie Parker Story, Part 1 and 3. Next week, you'll hear Part 2 and 4. The people who have performed with Charlie Parker were great people who really took a liking to him and actually were leaders in their own right later on after Parker passed on. That's Dizzy Gillespie, Ray Brown, Charlie Christian, Miles Davis, Max Roach, Earl Garner, Bud Powell, and Sonny Rollins. You have been listening to Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Dean. Hopefully you enjoyed the show. Stay tuned for next week for the continuation of the Great Charlie Parker. Have a good evening.